Hello, this is Radio Edge Talk. I'm John Johnson and I'm still at the e-learning conference in Dundee. It's Friday the 23rd of October at 1:03. And today, I've got Karen Strickland and Doug Belshaw, who have given up some of their valuable lunchtime to have a wee talk to us. We'll start off by just getting them to introduce themselves, maybe say where you come from, what excites you, where you are, whatever you like. Karen.
Okay. I'm from Edinburgh Napier University, where I'm a senior lecturer and senior teaching fellow in academic practice. What excites me is really helping people who are new to academic practice, new researchers, new scholars, and helping them develop and make their sort of first footsteps into becoming published scholars.
Right, that's, I mean, that sounds quite interesting. It sounds it will fit in quite well with a wee conversation we had last week with Christina Costa from Strathclyde. And Doug, I know you're well known, but
I'm from the internet. But I live in Northumberland, in England, at the moment. Although I'm probably going to move more or less at the time. So today this is, I think, my third e-assessment Scotland, and I'm talking about open badges, but it's not my session. It's Steve Sidaway from My Knowledge Maps. That's an instantiation of open badges. And I think what excites me as a former teacher is that, like, if you can sort out assessment and the credentialing of assessment, then you can change the way that learning happens. Because for better or for worse, assessment often drives the type of learning experiences that learners have. So if we can kind of sort that out and do things in a more innovative and different way, then my kids, especially, who are 6 and 2, will inhabit a better world. There we are. Okay, what that do?
That's a good target. that's a good target. Now, Karen, I think you're thinking about making a better world for lecturers and publishers by
creating open opportunities for open access publishing. There's been quite a big movement within academic press to encourage authors to publish in open access publications. But one of the concerns I have is that many of those big journals from big publishing houses are charging quite steep author processing fees. So for new scholars and early career researchers, they might not get the backing from institutions. So therefore we have launched a new journal, the Journal of Perspectives in Applied Academic Practice, which has no author publishing fees. It is completely open access and allows the copyright to be held by the author and the journal, to open up that opportunity in a nurturing environment as well. So it's open access and open peer review as well.
Do you think, I mean, one of the things, if you're on the internet, is very often you see links to academic journals, and you get there and it's, you then leave because you have to pay. So I presume that this would maybe help bring non-academic people or people interested in the topic, and they're not doing it as a part of their living, or they're not doing it as the main part of their job. It could bring them into reading more serious material, perhaps.
Yeah, hopefully, because it is, you know, anyone can access the journal and, you know, download any of the articles to read them online. We are hoping to open up a feature where we can allow commenting on the journal articles as well, but we haven't been able to do that yet because we did have a few spammers at the beginning. But we are looking at ways where we can do that as well, so creating some interaction from the readership of the journal as well.
That's it. This begins to get really interesting. And I know, Doug, you have seen the power of comments.
So just two things on that. Firstly, research has shown that people who publish in open access journals or publish in an open way get huge amounts more traction and people reading and interacting and that kind of thing. So that's the first thing. I wrote my doctoral thesis entirely online, as I think you know, John. So it amazes me the number of people who tell me they've read my thesis. I expect only my mother to have read my thesis, but like other people, like the person I was speaking to yesterday, this person in America said, "Oh, I read your thesis. Like what you did in chapter 8 or something." I can't remember what I did in chapter 8. It's insane. So that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is, I used to work for JISC, and when I was working for JISC, I was at Northumberland University, so I had access to journals in that kind of realm. And then, because I was a student at Durham, I had access to other journals. There was never a journal article, pretty much, that I couldn't access. Whereas now, when I'm working for Mozilla, I still need access to those things, but I feel like the only way I can do things is by DMing renegade academics who will email me kind of things. And it just feels a bit furtive and a bit wrong, so I end up only citing things which are in the open, which, to my mind, is the way things should be, but means that I don't cite some research which is really
valuable. You lose value. Yeah. Catherine Cronin was speaking earlier to us about, and she was talking about students publishing openly, but she was saying the open publishing, she thought, made for better, I'm putting words in her mouth probably, but made for better publications. If you're just publishing for a closed community or in an assessment case for one person, then you're talking to that one person. But if you're putting something out in the open, then you've got to bring the best you can to that. So have you seen any, Karen, that the effect that this has been having on authors?
I think it's early days. We've just published our first issue, but certainly we had a number of first-time authors mm-hmm. in the first issue, and we have some who are forthcoming in our second issue, which will be out in November. And I think for them, it's certainly been very motivating to get their first publication and people reading. I'm also very keen that, you know, within our whole sort of social media profile, that researchers and scholars are engaging with social media and promoting their own publications that they've published in our journal and in others, through tweeting the links, linking to it through the blog site and things as well. So it opens up that whole world of digital scholarship.
And the cost entry, really, I mean, we were talking earlier about there's hidden costs in terms of, you know, academic time and everything like that. But as you said, this is stuff that you will be doing for another journal, so why not kind of own the whole experience? And you can use tools which are very low-cost, open-source tools, kind of free tools. I spoke at the Irish Learning Technology Association's conference last year, and then they asked me to write a follow-up kind of article based on that keynote. And so the way that they formatted that in this kind of responsive WordPress site, which had my keynote, and then it had the article, and the way they'd kind of pull quotes out of it, was far better than I'd ever seen in any kind of journal, which, you know, like Elsevier or whatever, which is a billion-dollar or multi-billion-dollar market. It was really kind of eye-opening to see what you can do with a bit of enthusiasm and a bit of kind of joining together of tools.
Yeah, we're actually also hoping to encourage people to submit their work in different formats as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not, our first issue has been all text-based articles, but we are hoping to encourage people to submit maybe like Camtasia, mm-hmm. you know, presentations of the research and things as well. We haven't had any of those to date, but certainly the journal is open to different media formats.
Mm-hmm. So you could have an academic YouTube video.
We could
do that. That becomes quite interesting. As an old person, I like listening and I like reading, mm-hmm. and I don't go to YouTube for my first search for something.
No.
I'll go if somebody says you really got to watch that, and then I'll do it grudgingly. But you can see younger people, and by younger people I mean people coming into university and stuff now, or even at the other end of university, their first port of call for anything, if it's a question about their learning or a song or something, they're going to YouTube. Mm-hmm. So maybe
no, I mean, even so, just on that, so two things. My daughter managed to pour water down the side of my bath such that my lounge ceiling, I shouldn't say this because I'm selling my house, my lounge ceiling went a bit kind of bubbly and stuff. And so on a YouTube video, I learned how to kind of re-skim the surface, which was great. Like, it wasn't just one video. There was a plethora of videos I could choose from. I'd never really used YouTube as a search engine before, so that was awesome. And I always forget the second thing.
That's a good first thing.
It was a good first thing. Oh, never mind. Yeah, so I'll remember later.
But I mean, I think that's an interesting area that to look at, and it maybe doesn't. And one of the steps to go over is the fact that the people who are in control don't think of that as a medium, but maybe the people who are publishing and starting to publish, they will think of that. Maybe someday you'll have academic journal that is a YouTube channel.
I have noticed that some of the Elsevier journals have now got some annotated PowerPoints alongside some of the traditional journal articles as well. So there is a general move towards more multimedia formats, even from the traditional journals. But you know, having the journal, it's a solely online journal. When it's in a digital format, there's no reason why it has to be always text-based.
What I'd love to see is something like this, like some kind of podcast, but for academic articles in a given field. And I'm sure they must exist in some fields, because some fields are more innovative in that kind of sense. But something which gave me... So I listen to BBC Radio 4 podcasts, like, In Our Time, and thinking, I'm thinking a lot, especially because it pulls up journals and sociology and has really entertaining kind of ways of thinking through them, and it has the authors on there. So something like that, which gave an overview of a particular part of a field, not necessarily the whole field, but part of a field, even just from a kind of a journal point of view, you know, having some kind of audio which was in the podcast format, so you could, it would automatically appear, it would not only remind you to then go and look at the journal and read it, but also would give you a nice teaser as to which articles you might be interested in particular. I'd love to see something like that.
Well, my partner David, who'll be here this afternoon, is starting a sort of another channel on EduTalk where he's going to be talking to people who have done master's level work in education. The idea being it will be about the work they're doing and can form sort of, I'm not the best person to talk about this, but it will be of a value that can be said to be at that level, you know, rather than just a conversation. So if we're developing something like that, I'm sure there's lots of other people.
Well, you are kind of thinking about it, John. So yeah, I would encourage other people to go and have a look at tools that are available.
Yeah, but I think that would be quite interesting.
Yeah.
The other thing, Karen, and I don't know how much more time you guys have got, I'm interested in, is that you've got Open Review.
Yes.
How's that going?
It seems to be going really well. And Christina Costa actually blogged about her experience and our first impression. Now, we deliberately took the decision that the peer review process would be open, and we're supporting new people who are new to reviewing as well, so that can be quite a daunting prospect, but we firmly believe in the integrity of the peer review process, not the fact that it's traditionally been done in an anonymous way, the blind peer review. I don't think that is what gives it its integrity. Having published a number of articles in the past myself, not always got through and had many rejections as well. They're not always of a nurturing or developmental tone, and with our journal being specifically targeted at helping people who are new to writing, that if that was the first experience, if it was a nasty review, that could be very off-putting. So we believed, as the editorial team, we believed that if people are having to give their name as reviewers, they would be more cautious and measured about the tone of the feedback that they give. And we've provided some webinars for new authors and new reviewers as well to give some guidance around this. And that seems to be working well. So the authors are known, they're not blinded, and the peer reviewers are known as well. We also hope that in the future, with some of the feedback that we got from Christina's blog, that maybe we can open up channels for discussion between, more discussion between the authors and the reviewers as well.
And I think, again, that we talked earlier, and I've talked to a few people about this, people, if they're doing something in public, they make more of an effort. So if you're reviewing somebody, it's not only the author who's going to bring their best, it's the reviewer who's going to bring their best, and probably their nicer side rather than their
snarky side. So this is slightly tangential, but within a university context, when you have student essays which are submitted and they're usually anonymised, that's because it's within a closed system. And, you know, someone might be misogynistic or racist or whatever it's going to be, and you want to mitigate against that. But what John just said is absolutely true. Once you've got kind of the sunlight on it, as it were, people can see, actually, you've just been incredibly racist and kind of you just have made a complete assumption based on this person's name or whatever it is. And that brings, I think, a level of transparency, which means that people can't get away with doing that kind of stuff.
Because
what you were talking about, I was wondering why this hasn't happened before, why people haven't kind of ditched the double blind peer review process. But I think it is because of that, because it's a time when people can't get away with that kind of stuff easily. I mean, it still happens, but can't get away with it.
I think it's something that's I've seen on Twitter. My disciplinary background is in nursing, and there have been a few editors of some of the main nursing journals have been discussing the relative merits or not of blind peer review. But because of the they're fixed with the publishing restrictions that they have at the moment. But I think that's something that we will unpick, you know, as a kind of body of academics. I think that is something that will be unpicked. The blinding's not what gives us the integrity.
Cool.
So openness.
Openness
gives you integrity. Yeah. Well, thanks very much, Karen. Doug, have you anything else you'd like to say, or we're pushing on for the next?
No, we'll come to the next session. I'm working on a web literacy standard at the moment, and I would love people's feedback on that. It consists of a competency grade and skills underpinning those competencies. You can access that at the rather awkward URL. I'll help you put this in the show notes perhaps. It's mzl.la/weblitstd for web literacy standard. But what we need is feedback, people to think about their particular context and whether this particular web literacy standard as it currently stands would meet their needs, because we're going for a version 1.0 by the Mozilla Festival in October.
And is that feedback it's in the open?
So
what if I give feedback, give it a comment.
So the feedback form, and this isn't, I haven't kind of closed on purpose, the feedback form at the moment it's one of those Wolfram forms. So it gives the feedback directly to me. I respond directly to the person giving the feedback, but because I haven't asked for their consent to share their name anywhere,
certainly,
yeah, I've anonymised their feedback and put it in Etherpad, which you can access on the URL, which I'll give you in a moment.
Yeah, we'll get the URL straight away. I'm actually saying that for almost the opposite, because I've looked at the web literacy standards and had a few thoughts many times, but I've always thought if I bank some feedback in here, I haven't got the time. I mean, the amount of work that has been gone into that document is incredible, and the amount of work I would have to do to give feedback is
oh, so you don't need to give feedback on the entire thing.
No, I know.
If, for example, you're interested in privacy, just take that bit and say, well, you know, the wording here is problematic, or I think you've missed a skill here, because there's a whole thing which, like a layer of things which you need to do here, which is missed. So we value feedback. I know a lot of work has gone into it. But we value any and all feedback, even if it's just like high five saying thank you for doing this.
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely a high five, because I say I'm any feedback I've got, I would have to bring my A game to the feedback.
That's
the time it takes to do that is long, but it is a really exciting bit of work. So yourself, Karen, it sounds like another fantastic piece of work. I think it's an exciting time to be in education at the moment.
Absolutely.
When we hear stuff like this. So thanks very much.
Cheers.
Folks, I'll be on later on, I hope today. So we'll speak to you soon. And this audio, along with URLs and things, which Doug is just going to type into my iPad, will be up with the archive. Cheers.